Let's keep the pit between ourselves if we can, he said. The fewer people know, the better. Otherwise, we could run into problems. I agreed. The biggest problem for me was the Commendatore. It was almost impossible to explain the significance of the pit without bringing him, as an idea, no less, into the mix. Yes, as Manshiki said, mentioning the pit would only make things worse. And even if I did reveal the existence of the Commendatore, who would believe me? They'd just question my sanity. We emerged from the trees in front of the small shrine and circled around to the back. Stepping across the clump of pampas grass, whose plumes still lay cruelly flattened by the backhoe's treads, we arrived at the pit. The first thing we did was shine our lights on the boards covering the hole and the rows of stones that held them down. I checked the placement of the stones. The change was subtle, but I could tell they had been moved. Someone had come after Maria and me, removed the stones and several boards, and then, when they left, tried to return everything to its original position. My eyes could spot that slight difference. Someone moved the stones, I said. There are signs that the pit has been opened. Manshiki glanced at me. Do you think it was Maria? He asked. I wonder. It's not a place anyone would stumble upon, and apart from you and me, she's the only one who knows about it. So the chances are good it was Maria. The Commendatore knew about the pit, of course. After all, that was where he had come from. Yet, in the end, he was an idea. He had no fixed shape. He wouldn't have had to move those heavy stones if he wanted to go back inside. We removed the stones and took the boards away. Once again, the hole was exposed. It was perfectly round and not quite 6 feet across, but it looked bigger now. And blacker, too. I imagined that the darkness was what created the illusion. Manshiki and I leaned over the hole and directed our lights inside. No one was there. There was nothing at all. Just that empty, cylindrical space surrounded by the same stone wall. There was one difference, however. The ladder had vanished. The collapsible metal ladder that the landscaper had considerately left behind after moving the pile of boulders. I had last seen it leaning against the wall of the pit. Where did the ladder go? I wondered out loud. It didn't take us long to find it lying on its side some distance away in a stand of pampas grass that the backhoe hadn't flattened. Someone had taken it from the hole and chucked it there. It wasn't heavy, so moving it required no great strength. We returned the ladder to the hole and leaned it back against the wall. I'm going down to take a look, Manshiki said. Maybe I'll find something. Are you sure you'll be okay? Don't worry, I've been down there before. Manshiki descended the ladder with ease, lantern in hand. By the way, do you know the height of the Berlin Wall? He asked as he descended. No. 10 feet, he said, looking up at me. It varied depending on the location, but that was the standard height. A little taller than this hole is deep. It was about 100 miles long, too. I saw it with my own eyes, when Berlin was still divided into east and west. A pitiful sight. When Manshiki reached the bottom, he inspected the pit in the light from his lantern. Even then, though, he kept on talking to me. Walls were originally erected to protect people from external enemies, storms, and floods. Sometimes, though, they were used to keep people in. People are powerless before a sturdy, towering wall, visually and psychologically. Some walls were constructed for that specific purpose. Manshiki broke off at that point. Holding his lantern aloft, he examined every inch of the wall and the ground, intently and carefully, like an archaeologist poring over the inner sanctum of an Egyptian pyramid. His lantern was stronger than my flashlight, so it illuminated a much wider area. He seemed to have found something on the floor of the pit, for he knelt down and examined it closely. I couldn't make it out from above, though. Menshiki said nothing. Whatever it was, it must have been very small. He stood up, wrapped it in his handkerchief, and deposited it in the pocket of his windbreaker. He looked up at me. "I'm coming out," he said, raising his lantern into the air. "Did you find something?" I asked. Menshiki didn't answer. Carefully, he ascended the ladder. Each rung gave a dull creak under his weight. I kept close watch, my flashlight trained on him. The vantage point made me realize how well his daily routine had trained his body. Not a motion was wasted. Each muscle played its role perfectly. When he was back on the ground, he gave a big stretch and then brushed the dirt from his trousers with care. Not that there was much to brush off. "You can feel how intimidating the height of those walls is from down there. You really feel powerless. I saw something similar in Palestine a while ago. Israel erected a 25-foot concrete wall there with high-voltage wires running along the top. That wall is almost 300 miles long. I guess the Israelis figured 10 feet was too low, but that's enough to do the job." He set the lantern down. Now the ground around our feet was illuminated. "Come to think of it, the walls of the solitary cells in Tokyo prison measure about 10 feet as well," Menshiki said. "I don't know why they made them so high. All you had to look at were those blank walls day after day. Nothing else to lay your eyes on. No pictures or anything like that, of course. Just those damned walls. You start feeling like you've been thrown into a pit." I listened in silence. "I did some time in that place a while back. I haven't told you about that, have I?" "No, you haven't." My girlfriend had told me he had spent time in prison, but of course I didn't mention that. "I figure I should be the one to tell you. You know how gossips love to twist facts to spice up their stories, so it's better if I give it to you straight. It's not pretty, but this might be a good time to tell you. In passing, so to speak. Do you mind?"
"Not at all. Tell me."
"I'm not making excuses," he said after a moment's pause, "but I've done nothing to feel guilty about. I've tried my hand at many things in my life, borne many risks. Still, I'm not stupid, and I am cautious by nature, so I've always been careful to avoid anything illegal. I know where to draw the line. In this case, though, I happened to take on a partner who was careless. Because of him, I suffered a great deal. That experience taught me never to join forces with anyone again, to take responsibility for myself and no one else."
"What were you charged with?"
"Insider trading and tax evasion, what they call economic crimes. I was indicted and tried, but in the end they found me not guilty. All the same, the investigation was grueling, and I spent a pretty long time in prison. They found one reason after another to keep me locked up. I was in there for so long that now being surrounded by walls makes me a little nostalgic. As I said, I had done nothing to warrant punishment. My hands were clean, but the prosecutors had already concocted their scenario, and in it, I was guilty as sin. They had no desire to go back and rewrite it. That's how bureaucracies work. It's practically impossible to change something once it's been decided. Going against the current means that someone, somewhere down the line, has to take responsibility. As a result, I spent a long time in solitary."
"How long?"
435 days, Menshiki said, as if it were nothing. "A number I'll never forget, no matter how long I live." It wasn't hard to imagine what spending that much time in solitary meant.
Have you ever been confined in a small space for a long time? Manshiki asked me.
No, I said. My experience being locked in the back of the moving van had given me a bad case of claustrophobia. Now I couldn't even ride in an elevator. I'd fall apart if I were confined as he had been.
I learned how to endure it, Manshiki said. I spent the days training myself. In the process, I learned several foreign languages, Spanish, Turkish, and Chinese. They limit how many books you can keep in solitary, but those restrictions don't apply to dictionaries. In that sense, it's the ideal place to study languages. I'm blessed with good powers of concentration, so when I was focused on a language, I could forget the walls. There's a bright side to everything. Even the darkest, thickest cloud shines silver when viewed from above. Manshiki continued. What terrified me was the thought of earthquake and fire. Trapped like that, I could never have escaped. Imagining myself crushed or burned to death in that tiny space scared me so much sometimes I couldn't breathe. That was the one fear I couldn't overcome. It woke me up some nights.
But you got through it.
Of course. I'd be damned if I'd let those bastards beat me, or let their system grind me down. If I had signed the papers they laid in front of me, I could have walked out of my cell and returned to the world. But signing them would have meant my utter defeat. I would have admitted to crimes I hadn't committed. So I decided to treat the experience as an ordeal sent from above, an opportunity to test my strength.
Did you think about your time in prison when you spent that hour alone down in the pit?
Yes. I need to return to that experience once in a while. It's my starting point, so to speak, where the person I am today was formed. It's easy to get soft when life is comfortable.
What a peculiar guy, I thought again. How would another person react to treatment that harsh? Wouldn't they try to forget it as soon as possible?
As if remembering, Manshiki reached into the pocket of his windbreaker and pulled out something wrapped in a handkerchief. I found this at the bottom of the pit, he said. He unfolded the handkerchief, took out a small plastic object, and handed it to me. I examined it under my flashlight. It was a black and white penguin, barely half an inch long, with a tiny black strap attached to it. The kind of thing that schoolgirls like to attach to their cell phones and school bags. It was clean and looked quite new. It wasn't there the first time I went into the pit, Manshiki said. I'm sure of that.
So it must have been dropped by someone afterward, when they were down there.
I wonder. It looks like a cell phone ornament, and the strap isn't broken, so someone had to unhook it first.
Doesn't that suggest it wasn't dropped? That whoever left it did so intentionally?
You mean they entered the pit just to leave it there? Or dropped it down from above?
Why would anyone do that? I asked. Manshiki shook his head, as if he couldn't understand either.
It's possible that whoever it was left it as a charm or talisman. That's just a guess, though.
You mean Maria?
Probably. After all, it's doubtful anyone else was near the pit.
So she left it as a kind of charm?
Manshiki shook his head again. I don't know, he said. It's hard to read a 13-year-old girl. Their minds can come up with all sorts of stuff, can't they? I looked again at the tiny penguin in my hand. Now it struck me as a charm or amulet of some kind. An aura of innocence clung to it.
Then who pulled out the ladder and dragged it over there? What was the reason for that? I said.
Manshiki shook his head again. He had no idea either.
Anyway, I said, let's call Shoko when we get back and find out if Maria has a penguin charm on her cell phone. She should know one way or the other.
You hold on to the penguin for now, Manshiki said.
I nodded and put it in my trouser pocket.
We replaced the boards, leaving the ladder resting against the wall of the pit. When we put the stones back, I registered their exact positions in my mind. Then we headed home through the woods along the same path we had come on. I glanced at my watch. It was already past midnight. We said nothing, just shone our lights on our feet. We were both lost in thought. As soon as we got back, Manshiki went to his Jaguar, opened the big trunk, and placed the lantern inside. Then he shut the trunk and, as if finally allowing himself to relax, leaned against it and looked up at the sky. The black sky in which nothing was visible. "Do you mind if I come in for a few minutes?" he said. "It'd be hard for me to relax at home." "By all means. I don't think I can sleep yet either." Manshiki's eyes were still fixed on the sky. He seemed lost in thought. "I can't explain why," I said, "but I can't get rid of this feeling that something bad is happening to Maria, and that she's nearby."
"But not in the pit, right?"
"I guess not."
"What kind of bad thing?" Manshiki asked.
"That I don't know, but I feel she's in some kind of physical danger."
"And that the danger is lurking somewhere close to here, right?"
"Right," I said, "near here. And it bothers me that the ladder was removed from the pit. Who took it, and why did they hide it in the grass? What does it all mean?"
Manshiki stood up and gave me another pat on the shoulder. "You're right. I don't know either. But worrying about it won't get us anywhere. Let's go inside."
Chapter 47. It is now Friday, is it not? The moment we walked in the house, I threw off my leather jacket and called Shoko. She picked up on the third ring.
"Anything new?" I asked.
"Maria still hasn't called."
I could hear her struggling to breathe normally.
"Have you contacted the police?"
"No, not yet. It still feels too early somehow. I keep thinking she'll come wandering in the door."
I described the plastic penguin we had found at the bottom of the pit. Without detailing how we'd found it, I asked if Maria carried such an object with her.
"Yes, Maria had a penguin attached to her cell phone. It was a penguin, I'm sure. Yes, a penguin, without doubt. A tiny plastic figurine. She got it in a donut shop. It came free with her order, but she treasured it, as if it were a kind of protective charm."
"And she carried her phone wherever she went, correct?"
"Yes, it was turned off most of the time, but she always had it with her, yes. She didn't receive calls, but occasionally she'd call to let me know when something came up."
Shoko paused for a moment.
"Did you find it somewhere?"
I struggled to come up with an answer. If I told the truth, I'd have to tell her about the pit in the woods. If the police got involved, I would have to explain it to them as well, in a way they could swallow. Since the penguin was something she carried, they would comb the pit, even search the whole woods for further evidence. I would get the third degree, and Manshiki's past would be brought into it. I couldn't see how any of that would help. As Manshiki had said, it would just complicate things.
"I found it in the studio," I said. I hated to lie, but I had to. "When I was sweeping the floor, I thought that it might be Maria's."
"Yes, it's hers, I'm sure," said the girl's aunt. "But then what should I do? Should I call the police?"
"Have you heard from your brother? I mean, Maria's father?"
"No, I haven't been able to reach him," she said hesitantly. "I have no idea where he is. He's not someone who follows a regular schedule. I'm never sure if he's coming home or not."
The situation sounded complicated, but now wasn't the time to worry about that. I simply told her to inform the police of Maria's disappearance. It was after midnight, and the date had changed. It was possible that Maria had been in some kind of accident. She said she'd call them right away. So Maria still isn't answering her cell phone?
No, she isn't answering, though I've called her many times. It seems to be turned off, or the batteries are dead, one or the other.
She left this morning for school, and she's been missing ever since, right?
That's right.
Which means she should be in her school uniform, correct?
Yes, she should be. A navy blue blazer and vest, a white blouse, a knee-length plaid skirt, white socks, and black loafers. Oh, and a plastic shoulder bag with the school's name and emblem on it. She wasn't wearing a coat.
Didn't she have another bag for her art supplies?
She keeps that in her locker at school. She uses it when they have art class, and then takes it to your class on Fridays. She doesn't bring it from home.
That was the outfit she always wore to my class. Blue jacket, white blouse, tartan plaid skirt, plastic shoulder bag, and a white canvas bag with her paints and brushes. I could picture her perfectly. Was she carrying anything else?
No, not today. So I doubt she was going very far.
Please call me if you hear anything, I said. Any time of the day or night. She said she would. I hung up the phone. Manshiki was standing beside me throughout this conversation. Only after I put down the phone did he shed his windbreaker. Underneath was a black V-neck sweater. So the penguin was Marius after all, Manshiki said.
Seems so.
In which case, it's likely that she went into the pit at some point, we don't know when, and left her treasured penguin there. That's what we have so far.
So you think she left it there on purpose, as a protective talisman?
Probably.
But if that's so, who or what was it protecting?
Manshiki shook his head. I'm not sure, but it was clearly her lucky charm. So she must have left it behind for a reason. People don't part with things they value so easily. Unless it's to protect something they value more than themselves.
For example, Manshiki said.
Neither of us could answer that one. We sat there in silence. Slowly but surely, the hands of the clock inched ahead. Each tick pushed the world that much further forward. Outside the window stretched a vast darkness. Nothing moved there. It seemed nothing could. I suddenly recalled what the commendatore had said about the missing bell. The bell was never mine alone. It belonged to the place to be shared by everyone. So if it disappeared, there must have been a reason for it.
Belonged to the place?
Just maybe Maria didn't leave this penguin in the pit. Couldn't the pit be connected to some other location? Perhaps it isn't a sealed-off space, but a conduit of some kind. If that's the case, it might be able to summon all sorts of things. That is what I had been thinking, but said aloud it sounded ludicrous. The commendatore might have understood, but not anyone from this world. A deep silence settled over the room. So what could the bottom of the pit be connected to? Manshiki said at last, as if addressing himself. Remember, not so long ago I spent an hour alone down there, in the dark, without a light or a ladder. I tried to use the silence to focus my mind, to extinguish my physical existence and become pure consciousness. I figured if I could do that, I could transcend those stone walls and go wherever I liked. I used to try the same sort of thing when I was in solitary, but I couldn't find a way out of the pit. In the end, those walls allowed me no escape.
Perhaps the pit chose whom it wanted, I thought.
The commendatore had come to me when he left the pit, chosen me as his lodgings, so to speak. Maria, too, might have been chosen, but the pit hadn't chosen Manshiki, for whatever reason. In any case, I said, we're agreed. We won't tell the police about the pit. At this stage, anyway. Still, we're clearly concealing evidence if we keep our mouths shut about finding the penguin there. If they find that out, we could be in a sticky position.
Manshiki thought for a moment.
So we'll keep our lips sealed. That's all there is to it, he said at last. You found it on your studio floor. We'll go with that.
Maybe one of us should be with Shoko, I said. She's home by herself with no idea what to do, lost and confused. She's heard nothing from Maria's father. Doesn't she need someone there?
Manshiki furrowed his brow. I'm in no position to do that, he said at last, shaking his head. Her brother and I are total strangers, so if he came back...
Manshiki lapsed into silence. I had nothing to say either.
Manshiki sat there, lightly drumming his fingers on the arm of the sofa. Whatever he was thinking brought a slight flush to his cheeks.
Would you mind if I stayed a little longer? He asked a while later. Shoko may try to get in touch with us.
By all means, please do, I said. I don't think I'll be going to bed anytime soon. Stay as long as you like. You can sleep here, too. I'll lay out some bedding for you.
Manshiki said he might take me up on my offer.
Shall I make coffee? I asked.
Sounds good, Manshiki said.
I went to the kitchen, ground the beans, and started the coffee maker. When the coffee was ready, I took it out to the living room. Then Manshiki and I drank it together. I think I'll build a fire, I said. The room had grown markedly colder once midnight passed. It was already December, an appropriate time for the first fire of the season. I filled the cast iron grate in the fireplace with the small stack of firewood I had set aside in the corner of the living room. Then I inserted paper under the grate and lit a match. The wood appeared to be dry, for it caught right away. I was worried that the fireplace might back up. Masahiko had said it was set to go, but you never knew until you used it. A bird could have nested in the chimney. Fortunately, however, it worked beautifully. We moved our chairs in front of the fireplace and sat there in the warmth.
Nothing beats a wood fire, Manshiki said.
I thought of offering him some whiskey, but changed my mind. Tonight, we should stay sober. Who knows, we might have to drive somewhere. So we listened to records and watched the flames dance. Manshiki selected a Beethoven violin sonata and put it on the turntable. Georg Kuhlenkampf on violin with Wilhelm Kempf on piano. Perfect music for an early winter night before a fire. It was hard to enjoy it, though, with Maria out there shivering in the cold.
Shoko called half an hour later. Her brother had just come home and had already contacted the police. They would be there any moment to investigate. The Akikawas were an old and wealthy family in the area, so the possibility that it was a kidnapping was making them move quickly. There was no word from Maria, and calling her cell phone still didn't work. They had contacted every likely person they could think of, there weren't that many, with no luck. No one knew where Maria had gone.
Let's hope she's all right, I said. I asked her to let me know if there was any progress, and hung up the phone. We sat before the fire and listened to another record, Richard Strauss's Oboe Concerto. Manshiki plucked that off the shelf as well. It was the first time I had heard it. We sat there side by side as it played, watching the fire and thinking our solitary thoughts. At 1:30, I suddenly grew terribly sleepy. I could barely keep my eyes open. I've always been an early-to-bed, early-to-rise kind of guy, so late nights are hard on me.
Go ahead and turn in, Manshiki said, looking directly at me. Shoko may call again, so I'll stay up a while longer. I don't need much sleep. I can skip a night without any problem. Always been that way. So please don't worry about me. I'll keep the fire burning. I can watch it while I listen to music. Do you mind?
Of course not, I said. I brought in another load of firewood from the shed outside the kitchen and stacked it next to the fireplace. More than enough, I thought, to last until morning.
Well then, I'm off to bed, I said to Manshiki.
Sleep tight, he answered. Let's rotate. I'll probably sleep for a bit around daybreak. Could you lend me a blanket or something?
I went and got the blanket Masahiko had used, a down duvet, and a pillow, and arranged them on the sofa. Manshiki thanked me. I have whiskey if you'd like some, I added. Manshiki gave a brusque shake of his head.
No, no alcohol for me tonight. We don't know what could happen.
If you get hungry, please help yourself to the food in the fridge. There's not much, but there's crackers and cheese at least.
Thanks, Manshiki said.
Leaving him there, I retired to my room. I slipped under the covers, flicked off the bedside light, and tried to go to sleep. Yet sleep didn't come. I was exhausted, but a tiny bug was whirring in my brain. This happens sometimes. I gave up, switched the light back on, and got out of bed.
What might be the problem, my friends? The commendatore said. You cannot sleep.
I looked around the room. There he was, sitting on the windowsill, clad in the same white garment. Strange pointy-toed shoes, a miniature sword by his side. His hair neatly tied back. As always, a perfect replica of the commendatore who was stabbed to death in Tomohiko Amada's painting.
You're right, I can't sleep, I said. There is indeed a great deal happening these days, said the commendatore. No wonder people struggle so to drift off, to no avail.
It's been a long time, hasn't it? I said.
I cannot attest to that. I think I told my friends before, but long time is lost on us ideas. We cannot fathom it's been a long time or sorry not to have written in so long.
Still, your timing is perfect. There's something I need to ask you.
And what, then, is the question?
Maria Akikawa went missing this morning and everyone is out looking for her. Where on earth could she have gone? The commendatore cocked his head to one side and thought for a moment.
As my friends know, he said, choosing his words carefully, the human realm is ruled by three elements, time, space, and probability. Ideas, by contrast, must remain independent of all three. I cannot, therefore, concern myself with matters of the sort that my friends have just described.
I can't entirely follow you. Is the problem that you can't foresee the outcome? The commendatore didn't answer. Or is it that you know but can't tell me? The commendatore narrowed his eyes in thought.
I am not evading responsibility. Ideas have our own constraints.
I stiffened my back and looked him square in the face.
Let's get things straight. I must save Maria Akikawa. She may be in great danger and needing my help. She has likely wandered into a place from which she cannot escape. That's the feeling I get anyway. Still, I'm at a loss how to find her, and I think her disappearance is linked in some way to the pit in the woods. I can't give you a rational explanation, but I'm quite sure there's a connection. Now, you've spent a very long time confined in that same hole. I have no idea what led you to be shut up there. Nevertheless, whatever may have been the case, Manshiki and I brought in heavy equipment, moved the pile of boulders, and opened the pit. We set you free. That's true, isn't it? Thanks to us, you are now able to move throughout time and space with no restriction, appear and disappear as you like. You can even watch me making love to my girlfriend. All this is as I say, isn't it?
Affirmative, my friends. Affirmative. I'm not demanding that you tell me precisely how Maria can be saved. I'm not asking the impossible. I can see that the world of ideas has its own restrictions. But can't you give me a hint? After all I've done for you, don't you think you owe me at least that much?
The commendatore gave a deep sigh.
An indirect, roundabout hint is enough. I'm not trying to accomplish anything earth-shaking here, like putting a stop to ethnic cleansing or global warming or saving the African elephant. All I'm trying to do is find one 13-year-old girl who's likely caught somewhere in some small, dark place and return her to this world.
The Commendatore sat there for a long time, lost in thought, his arms folded. He seemed to be having second thoughts.
"Affirmative, my friends," he said with resignation. "When you speak in such a fashion, there is not much I can do. I will give my friends but a single hint. Yet be warned, several sacrifices may be required. Are you willing nonetheless?"
"What sort of sacrifices?"
"I cannot speak much of that yet, but they will be inevitable. Metaphorically speaking, there will be blood. That is an inevitable fact. What sorts of sacrifices are involved should grow clearer as time passes. Someone may have to risk his life."
"I don't care. Give me the hint."
"Affirmative," the Commendatore said. "It is now Friday, is it not?"
I checked my bedside clock.
"Yes, it's still Friday. No, wait a minute, it's Saturday already." "On Saturday morning before noon, my friends will receive a phone call," the Commendatore said. "For an invitation somewhere. No matter the circumstances, my friends must not decline that invitation. Do you understand?"
I mechanically repeated what he had just said. "Someone will call me this morning and invite me somewhere. I must not decline."
"Hold those words close," said the Commendatore, "for it is the only hint I am able to share. It traverses the narrow line that divides public and private parlance."
With those final words, the Commendatore began to fade away. Before I knew it, his form had disappeared from the window ledge. I turned off the bedside lamp, and this time fell asleep with relative ease. The whir of insect wings in my head was gone. A moment before I went under, I imagined Manshiki sitting in front of the fire, absorbed in his thoughts. I guessed he would keep the fire burning all night. I had no idea what those thoughts might be, of course. He was a strange man. But it went without saying that his life was bounded by time, space, and probability, like everyone else's in this world. None of us could escape those constraints as long as we lived. Each of us was enclosed by sturdy walls that stretched high in the air, surrounding us on all sides. Probably. "Someone will call me this morning and invite me somewhere. I must not decline." I parroted the Commendatore's words one more time in my head. Then I slept.
Chapter 48. The Spaniards simply couldn't navigate the angry seas off the Irish coast. I woke shortly after 5. It was still dark outside. I slipped a cardigan over my pajamas and went to check the living room. Manshiki was sleeping on the sofa. He hadn't been asleep for long. The fire was out, but the room was still warm. The stack of firewood had shrunk. He was sleeping peacefully on his side, breathing quietly with a duvet draped over his body, not snoring at all. His manners governed even the way he slept. The room seemed to be holding its breath so as not to disturb him. Leaving him there, I went into the kitchen and brewed coffee. I made some toast as well. Then I carried the toast and coffee into the dining area and sat there, munching and sipping as I read my book. It was about the Spanish Armada, about the unfolding of the brutal conflict upon which Queen Elizabeth and Philip II had staked the fortunes of their nations. Why did I feel compelled to read an account of that late 16th century sea battle off the coast of Great Britain at that particular moment?
All I knew was that once I started reading, I couldn't stop. It was an old book I had found on Tomohiko Amada's shelf. While standard accounts claim that faulty strategy caused the Armada's decimation by the English fleet, a defeat that changed the course of history, this book argued that most of the damage was caused not by direct fire from English cannon, volleys by both sides, it appeared, missed their targets to fall harmlessly into the ocean, but by shipwreck. Accustomed to the calm waters of the Mediterranean, the Spaniards simply couldn't navigate the angry seas off the Irish coast, and thus ran vessel after vessel against the dark reefs. As I followed the sad fate of the Spanish Navy and sipped my second cup of black coffee, the sky gradually brightened in the east. It was Saturday morning. "Someone will phone you, my friends, this morning, and invite you somewhere. You must not decline." I mentally repeated what the Commendatore had told me. Then I looked at the phone. It preserved its silence. But it would ring at some point, I was sure of that. The Commendatore was not one to lie. All I could do was be patient and wait. I thought of Maria. I wanted to call her aunt to find out if she was safe, but it was still too early. I should wait until 7 o'clock at least. Her aunt would contact me if Maria was found. She knew how worried I was. No word from her meant no progress. So I sat at the dining table reading about the invincible Armada and, when I tired of reading, staring at the phone. But the phone maintained its silence. I called Shoko shortly after 7. She answered immediately, as if she had been sitting beside the phone waiting for it to ring. "We haven't heard from her. She's still missing," she said right away. She sounded as if she'd had little, or maybe no, sleep. Fatigue filled her voice. "Are the police looking?" I asked. "Yes, 2 officers came last night. We gave them photographs of Maria, described what she was wearing. We explained that she isn't the kind of girl who would run away or stay out late partying. They spread the word, and by now I'm sure it's been broadcast to all the precincts. I've asked them not to make the search public yet, of course." "But nothing so far, correct?" "That's right, no leads up to this point. I'm sure they're working very hard on it, though." I did my best to console her and asked her to let me know the moment something did turn up. She promised she would. When our call ended, Menshiki had already risen and was scrubbing his face in the bathroom sink. After brushing his teeth with the toothbrush I had set aside for him, he sat across from me at the dining room table and drank his black coffee. I offered him toast, but he declined. Sleeping on the sofa had mussed his luxuriant hair a bit more than usual, but then his usual was super neat. The man sitting there was the same cool-headed, well-groomed guy as always. I related my conversation with Shoko. "This is just my gut feeling," he said when I finished. "But I doubt the police will be very much help." "Why is that?" "Maria is no typical teenager, and her disappearance is no typical disappearance. I don't think she was kidnapped either. That means the usual police methods are likely to hit a wall." I didn't offer an opinion, but I figured he was right. We had been given an equation with multiple functions, but almost no solid numbers. To make any progress, we had to nail down as many numbers as possible. "Shall we go take another look at the pit?" I asked. "Who knows, there might be some change."
"Let's go," Menshiki said.
We were operating under the tacit assumption that nothing else was to be done. I knew that the phone could ring and that Shoko Akikawa or the person behind the invitation the Commendatore had mentioned might be on the other end, but I was pretty sure neither would call this early. Call it a vague premonition on my part. We put on our jackets and headed out. It was a sunny day. A southwesterly wind had swept away the cloud cover of the previous night, leaving behind a sky almost unnaturally high and transparent. Indeed, when I raised my eyes to the sky, I had the feeling that up and down had been reversed, and that I was peering down into a spring of clear water. I could hear the faint drone of a long train running along a faraway track. When the air was like this, you could pick up distant sounds on the wind with great clarity. That's the sort of morning it was. Without exchanging a word, we cut through the woods and around the little shrine. The plank cover of the pit was exactly as we had left it the night before, nor had the stones holding it down been moved. When we took off the boards, the ladder was still leaning against the wall, its position unchanged. No one was in the pit. This time, Manshiki didn't offer to go down to search the floor. The bright sunlight made that unnecessary. We could see that nothing had changed. The pit looked altogether different in the light of day than it had at night. There was nothing at all unsettling about it. We replaced the lid and rearranged the stones that held it down. Then we walked back through the woods. In front of my house, Manshiki's spotless silver Jaguar sat reticently beside my dusty, unpretentious Toyota Corolla. When he reached his car, Manshiki came to a halt. "I think I'll head home," he said. "I'll just be in your way if I presume on your hospitality any longer, and there's nothing I can do now anyway. Do you mind?" "Of course not. Please go home and rest. I'll let you know right away if there's any change."
"Today is Saturday, isn't it?"
"That's right, it's Saturday." Manshiki reached into his windbreaker pocket and pulled out his key. He stood there staring at it for a moment, thinking, trying to make his mind up about something, perhaps. I waited for him to reach a conclusion.
"There's one thing I should probably tell you," he said at last.
I leaned on the door of my Corolla as he figured out what to say.
"It's actually quite personal, so I wasn't sure if it was appropriate. But then I thought perhaps I should, for courtesy's sake. I don't want to cause any needless misunderstandings. Anyway, the thing is, Shoko and I have become, what's the correct word, quite intimately involved."
"You mean you and she are lovers?" I asked, cutting to the chase.
"Exactly," Manshiki replied after a moment's pause.
I thought I saw a faint blush rise to his cheeks.
"You may think it quite hasty."
"No, the speed isn't the problem."
"That's correct," Manshiki acknowledged. "The speed is not the problem."
"The problem is," I began,
"my motives. You were going to say, am I correct?"
I didn't respond, yet it was clear that my silence meant yes.
"You should know," he said, "that none of this was planned from the beginning. It was an entirely natural development. In fact, it happened without me being conscious of it. You may find that hard to believe, of course."
I sighed, then I spoke frankly. "All I know is that if you started with that plan in mind, it would have been pretty easy to carry out. I'm not being sarcastic either."
"You're probably right," Manshiki said. "I recognize that. Easy, or at least not all that difficult. Perhaps. But that's not how it was."
"So are you saying that you met Shoko Akikawa for the first time and fell in love right off the bat, or something like that?"
Manshiki pursed his lips as if embarrassed. "Fell in love? No, I can't make that claim. To be honest, the last time I fell in love, I think that's probably what it was ages ago. I can't even remember what it was like. But I can say with confidence that I find myself powerfully attracted to Shoko, as a man is attracted to a woman."
"Leaving Maria out of the picture?"
"That's hard to know. Maria was the reason for our first meeting, after all. But had Maria never existed, I think I still would have been attracted to her aunt."
I wondered about that. Would a man whose mind was as complicated as Manshiki's be so powerfully attracted to a woman as simple and easygoing as Shoko Akikawa? Still, I was in no position to judge. The workings of the human heart are impossible to predict, especially when sex is involved. I understand, I said. At any rate, thank you for speaking so honestly. Honesty is always best, I think.
I hope you're right.
To tell you the truth, Maria already knew that you and Shoko had begun that sort of relationship. In fact, she came to talk to me about it a few days ago.
The news seemed to catch Manshiki by surprise. She's a perceptive child, he said. We tried our best not to let her find out.
Yes, a very perceptive child. But she didn't find out from you. It was the things her aunt said and did that tipped her off.
Shoko was a well-brought-up, intelligent woman, but while she could conceal her feelings to a degree, her mask was bound to slip sooner or later. Manshiki was aware of that, no question.
If that's the case, do you think Maria's disappearance is connected to her discovery of our relationship?
I shook my head. I can't tell for sure, but I can tell you that you and Shoko ought to talk through everything together. She's beside herself with worry and she's confused. She must be in need of your encouragement and support, urgently in need.
You're right. I'll contact her the minute I get home.
Manshiki wasn't finished. Something else appeared to be on his mind. He sighed.
To tell the truth, I don't think I've fallen in love. I'm not cut out for that. Haven't been from the beginning. I don't know why I feel as I do. Would I have been so attracted to Shoko if not for Maria? The connection between the two of them isn't clear to me at all.
I said nothing.
But I swear I didn't plan any of it in advance. Can you believe me?
Mr. Manshiki, I said, I can't explain why, but I think you're an honest man at heart.
Thank you, he said.
The corners of his mouth edged upward. It was a somewhat uncomfortable smile, but not an altogether unhappy one.
Can I go on being honest? He said.
Of course.
Sometimes I think I'm empty, he confessed.
The smile still lingered on his lips.
Empty? Hollow inside. I know it sounds arrogant, but I've always operated on the assumption that I was a lot brighter and more capable than other people. More perceptive and discerning, with greater powers of judgment. Physically stronger, too. I figured I could succeed at whatever I turned my mind to, and I did. Put my hands on whatever I wanted to possess. Being locked up in Tokyo prison was a clear setback, of course, but I considered that an exception to the rule. When I was young, I saw no limits to what I could achieve. I thought I could attain a state close to perfection. Climb and climb until I reached a height where I could gaze down on everyone else. But when I passed 50, I looked at myself in the mirror and discovered nothing but emptiness. A zero. What T.S. Eliot called a straw man. I couldn't think of anything to say. My whole life may have been a mistake up till now, Manshiki went on. I feel that way sometimes. That I took a wrong turn somewhere. That nothing I've done has any real meaning. That's why I told you I often find myself envying you.
Envying what, for example?
You have the strength to wish for what you cannot have, while I have only wished for those things I can possess.
I assumed he was talking about Maria. She was the one thing that had evaded his grasp, yet there wasn't much I could say about that. Manshiki slowly got into his car. Then he rolled down the window, said goodbye, and drove off. When his car was out of sight, I went back into the house. It was just past 8. The telephone rang at shortly after 10. The call was from Masahiko.
I know it's sudden, he said, but I'm on my way to Izu to see my father. Would you like to come along? You mentioned the other day that you'd like to meet him.
Someone will phone my friends tomorrow morning and invite you somewhere. You must not decline.
That's great. I'd love to go. I just got on the Tokyo-Nagoya Expressway. I'm at the Kohoku parking area now. I think it'll take me about an hour to reach you. I'll pick you up and we can drive to Izukogen.
Did something happen to your father?
Yeah, the nursing home called. Seems he's taken a turn for the worse. So I'm going to check on him. I'm more or less free today anyway.
Are you sure it's all right if I go along? Aren't times like this for family only?
Don't worry, it's perfectly okay. No other relatives will be there, so the more the merrier.
He hung up. I put down the phone and scanned the room. Was the commendatore around? But he was nowhere to be seen. Prophecy dispensed, he had disappeared, probably to a realm where the dictates of time, space, and probability did not apply. Nevertheless, there had been a morning phone call, and I had been invited somewhere. So far, at least, that prophecy had been accurate. It bothered me to leave with Maria still unaccounted for, but I couldn't do much about that. The commendatore had instructed me, no matter the circumstances, my friends must not decline that invitation. I could leave Shoko in Menshiki's hands. After all, she was his responsibility to some extent. I sat back in the easy chair in the living room and resumed the story of the invincible armada as I waited for Masahiko. Almost all the Spanish soldiers and seamen who had managed to escape their shipwrecked vessels and crawl onto the shores of Ireland, more dead than alive, were murdered by those who lived along the coast. The poverty-stricken locals had slaughtered them for their possessions. It had been the Spaniards' hope that, as fellow Catholics, the Irish might show them mercy, but they were out of luck. Religious solidarity was no match for the fear of starvation. Sadly, the Spanish ship carrying the war chest holding the gold and silver intended to buy off England's powerful nobility sank as well. No one knew where all that wealth had gone. It was shortly before 11 in the morning when Masahiko's old black Volvo pulled up in front of my house. I was still thinking about all those gold coins lying at the bottom of the sea as I threw on my leather jacket and headed out the door. The route Masahiko chose took us from the Hakone Turnpike to the Izu Skyline Highway and then down from the Amagi Highlands to Izu. He explained that this way would be faster, that the weekend meant the coastal roads would be jammed, but nevertheless, our route was crowded with people out on excursions. The leaf-viewing season had not yet ended, and many of those on the road were weekenders unfamiliar with mountain driving, so the trip took a lot longer than expected. "Is your father really in bad shape?" I asked.
"He's not long for this world, that's for sure," Masahiko said lightly. "A matter of days, to be more precise. Age has whittled him down to almost nothing. He has trouble eating, and pneumonia is a constant threat. But the patient's orders are that under no circumstances are IV lines and feeding tubes to be used. In other words, he demands that he be allowed to go quietly once he can no longer eat. He arranged this with his lawyer when he was still mentally competent, signed the forms and everything, so there will be no interventions. That means he could go at any time."
"So I guess you have to be prepared for the worst."
"That's about right."
"It must be rough."
"Hey, it's a big deal when someone dies. I can hardly complain."
The old Volvo was equipped with a tape deck, and the glove compartment was stuffed with cassettes. Masahiko stuck his hand in, grabbed one, and inserted it without checking to see what it was. It turned out to be a collection of hits from the 1980s,
Duran Duran, Huey Lewis, and so on. When ABC's The Look of Love came on, I turned to him. "Sure feels like time has stopped in this car," I said. "I don't like CDs. They're too shiny,